USA Radio News.
Moments ago, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg began his testimony before the Senate. A portion of that testimony dealt with how Facebook handles questionable content.
We basically had to enforce our content policies reactively. People could share what they wanted, and then if someone in the community found it to be offensive or against our policies, they'd flag it for us and we'd look at it reactively. Now, increasingly, we are developing AI tools that can identify certain classes of bad activity proactively and flag it for our team at Facebook. By the end of this year, by the way, we're going to have more than 20,000 people working on security and content review, working across all these things. So when content gets flagged to us, we have those people look at it, and if it violates our policies, then we take it down.
Quick look at your numbers on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up over 400 points. This is USA Radio News.
Ryan, I don't know how else to say this, so I'll just say it.
What is it, Linda?
I think we should see other people.
Are you breaking up with me on a roller coaster?
Well, we do have a lot of fun. Maybe we should stay together.
An emotional roller coaster? Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to Geico.
I just need a little me time.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
I used to wonder why people took their own pillows into the hotels with them till I got a MyPillow, and I go everywhere with mine. Stays cool all night, keeps its shape, 60-day money-back guarantee, and a 10-year warranty made in the USA. Go to MyPillow.com. Click on the 4-pack special, enter promo code USA. You get 2 MyPillow premium pillows, 2 go-anywhere pillows for half off. Go to MyPillow.com or call 1-800-951-8175. Use promo code USA.
Could the U.S. economy's job creation be waning? USA Radio Network's Chris Barnes reports.
On the heels of a disappointing government jobs report for March comes a report showing that companies have announced plans to cut 60,000 jobs, an increase of 39% from a year ago. That report's coming from the private firm Challenger Gray & Christmas, which says taken together, the jobs report and the cuts report could suggest that growth is slowing down. But a different view from analyst Daniel DiMartino Booth, especially when it comes to that March jobs report.
As bad as the headline number seemed, I mean, it was basically half of what expectations were, that really, if you combine February's blowout, 325,000, with March's 100,000 that was disappointing, you throw the two of them together, and it was an okay report.
For USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
Bill Cosby's lawyer launched into a courtroom attack on the comedian's attorney, accusing her of being a con artist just after money. This is USA Radio News.
The following update is for drivers who pay too much for car insurance due to DUIs, DWIs, tickets, or anything else. Our company specializes in low-cost SR22 auto insurance. We know that mistakes happen and offer free quotes for very affordable auto insurance meant specifically for you, the overpaying high-risk driver. The quote is free and we'll handle the filing so you can start saving money. Call 800-758-0725. 800-758-0725. 800-758-0725.
Many times you hear grandparents or even parents say, kids just aren't as kind as they once were. Well, what can be done to bring that back? Dr. Thomas Lacona has 40 years in dealing with children. He's also the author of a new book titled, How to Raise Kind Kids. I had a chance to ask him three common mistakes that parents make.
Well, the first is not being intentional about the sort of family you want to be, but just being carried along by whatever the cultural trends are. Be more deliberate about the sort of family we want to be. So sitting down and saying, what kind of a family do we want to be? Making a family mission statement, having family meetings that follow up on that, having connective rituals like bedtime reading and one-on-one time with our children that strengthen our relationship. Being much more intentional, not just being carried along by the culture. So one mistake is not being intentional in creating a family culture. Second is giving kids a free ride. Two-thirds of parents now say they feel they've spoiled their children. They really haven't asked them to contribute to family life. They don't have a system of chores. Kids aren't really doing their part to pull their weight in the family. Parents are the providers, kids are the consumers, and that's a recipe for entitled children. And another mistake is just trying to be your child's friend and not the authority in the family. The research shows that it's authoritative parents who have a strong sense of the right to be respected and obeyed, also who love their children, give the kids a fair hearing, listen to their feelings, and so on. But basically, mom and dad are in charge, and they expect their children to obey them.
For USA Radio News, my name is Tim Berg.
Hi, this is Joe Peters, and I'm sitting here with Bruce Dorling. Say hello, Bruce.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about Raritan Township history. Bruce is the local historian for Raritan Township. And
Raritan Borough.
Yeah, yes, there is a difference. Okay. You're right. I was testing to see if you're listening. But first, we're going to go out to the weather, and we'll be right back.
This is Georgine Trinkle. I want to invite you to listen to Hot and Hunterd In every Monday from 4 to 5 p.m. You'll be treated to discussions on hot topics every week. Hot and Hunterd In provides a more in-depth look at issues that are happening right now. You can catch the show live and call in on what matters to you. Make sure to download the podcast to catch up on all our hot topics.
So, hi, it's Joe Peters, and they asked me to give you the weather report. So, just to set the record straight, it's a little bit after 4 o'clock. It is April 10th, and we're sitting in scenic downtown Flemington. We're going to do a show on the history of Raritan Borough and some of its more famous people. And before that, we're going to give you a little bit of the weather. So, the good news is it looks like we're going right from winter to summer. It is 50 degrees today, 54 tomorrow, 66 on Thursday, 76 on Friday. Can you believe 76? And then 79 on Saturday. Back to 54 on Sunday, so we'll get back to somewhat reasonable. I don't see a lot of precipitation. It's mostly sun and clouds. And overnight, we're going to get down only to about 50 degrees each night. Tonight's going to be about 31, but after that, it's going to be 40, then 54, and then 58. So it sounds like it's over. Sort of good news. We've been waiting for this a long time. Let me play a few of our paid commercials, and we'll be right back to get started.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org. You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Sabía que de cada cinco personas hay una que lucha con síntomas difíciles de salud mental. NAMI es una organización estatal sin fines de lucro. Somos empleados voluntarios. Somos la voz de la nación sobre las enfermedades mentales. NAMI te ofrece grupos de apoyo, educación e información. Nuestro programa educativo de Familia a Familia está dirigido por miembros de NAMI para familiares y amigos de personas que luchan con dificultad de salud mental. Llámanos al 888-803-3413. Recuerda, no estás solo. NAMI está contigo y no hay salud sin salud mental.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
Hey, and this is the real Joe Peters. So we do two shows at Tuesday at 4. One week I do Real Estate Matters, and the other week I do 55 Plus. This one sort of falls in between because I think people move to our area because of history. And I think the people like myself that are 55 Plus, really plus anymore, more plus than I'd like it to be, but I have a real interest in history. I know I do. And I met Bruce over at the Somerset Chamber. And he and I went out to breakfast, and we got to talking about what he does for the town of Raritan and their history. And I said, I got to get you on the radio. This is fascinating. I think some of our people would like to hear about it and what goes on over in Raritan. Bruce, why don't we start by a little bit about your background. Where'd you go to school at, and what kind of work have you done?
I graduated from Middletown North in 1979, and graduated from Stockton State College in 1984. And later on, I went back for my MBA at Fairleigh Dickinson College and worked at AT&T for 14 years. And after that, pretty much went the entrepreneur way. I had my own kids' party place for 3 years.
Wow.
In Raritan. And now I have a mobile DJ business where, like all the mobile DJs, you go out, you do the weddings, the birthday parties.
Well, great. Great. We're going to leave a few minutes at the end of the show to talk just about that. How did you get interested or involved in the history of the borough of Raritan?
I moved to Raritan. I've been in Raritan 26 years now. The first 13 years, I was not into history. One day, I was up at the Raritan, in the Raritan Library, and there was a museum for John Bazelon, who's their hero from World War II.
Right.
And there was a room in there that told about his heroics. And I looked at it. And I said, everything here, this is a heroic story that's like Hollywood. I'm surprised no one's done a movie about him. And I asked the librarian, has anyone done a book about him? And she says, no.
Wow.
I said, somebody should. And I said, well, that someone should be me. So I decided to make the book myself, talk to the people in Raritan. And it was a... What kicked off my history hobby was that so many people were happy to help me
right.
to put this inspiring story into a book, which sold 1,000 copies locally, and it was used by HBO in the Pacific.
Okay.
And I just saw the putting the effort in, getting the response from people. It truly worked. It was worth doing.
And what year was that?
This was 13 years ago.
13 years.
And that just ignited my history passion. And it's been one story after another. I write a monthly feature story for the Bridgewater Raritan newspaper,
right.
The Breeze, and a variety of history stories.
So tell us a little about John Bazelon, is the way you say it?
John Bazelon.
Okay, Bazelon.
He lived in Raritan.
Okay.
He was a bit of trouble as a kid. More so trouble to himself than to hurt anyone else.
Right.
He enlisted in the Marines before World War II. And at Guadalcanal during World War II, 1942, this was the time when we were not doing very well in the war.
Right.
And the turning point was at Guadalcanal, where we held an island. And at this point, we really didn't have the manufacturing capabilities, all the ships up and going, like did the end of the war. This was October 1942, and the Japanese were trying to retake the island. We had initially taken the island away from them, a very strategic location which had an airfield, and the Japanese were looking to take it back. But when they charged at various positions at night, Bazelon and many others defended those positions, and Japanese took tons of casualties. And it really was a turning point in the war. The Japanese lost a lot of men. The U.S. They built a lot of confidence with that battle. It was their first land battle. The Japanese had been undefeated before. They had won every battle. The U.S. was really not prepared to fight. And that day at Guadalcanal, it was named the Battle for Henderson Field. That was the airfield.
Right.
Bazelon was one of the leading machine gun gunners. That it says that there were 38 enemy soldiers that he had killed. And in addition to the killing, to taking out the enemy, he had repaired some machine guns in the dark that were broken. And they trained to be able to assemble a machine gun blindfolded. So you know, if you were in a battle, so he had two machine guns broken. He'd take parts from one, you know, parts from both to create one working.
Wow.
So him and his guys in the little bunker would still have to be able to fire. And also, one of the legendary things about Bazelon that night is he ran through the jungles of Guadalcanal to get more ammunition. And he retrieved six cartridge belts, which I believe weighed 18 pounds each, and was able to bring them back into the fight, so he and his men would have that. And today, there's a statue in Raritan about John Bazelon, and the statue has him with the cartridge belts over his shoulder, symbolizing that moment where, in the lull of the battle, he ran through the jungle to get the ammunition by himself.
What an amazing story. So what happened to him after that?
A few months later, he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, which is the highest honor you can be bestowed in the military. So they sent him home on a bond tour. Raising money was a big thing, and having the war heroes go out made people come to the bond rallies. They would have celebrities, various movie stars, and then some of the war heroes. So Bazelon came home, was put on the bond tour, and after a few months, he's like, "This is nuts. I'm a soldier. This war is still going on. And your orders for me are to sit here with Hollywood people, shake hands, say hi to people. That was good for a bit, but there's a war going on. I really want to go back." So after about several months of the bond tour, he was granted permission to return to the action. And he got the action he wanted. He was landed the first day at what's now famous, which was unknown then, Iwo Jima.
Right.
First day on Iwo Jima, they stormed ashore. The enemy Japanese were... They had months to plan. They were underground. Some of the things were as many as seven floors deep. They had various embankments and emplacements. So the Japanese were ready for them, and the battle then was really stalled. And one of the guys that got the battle going for them was Bazelon. He actually ran and organized the men, and they were able to break through and knock out one of the key blockhouses so many more guys could move up and get the battle started. But unfortunately, Bazelon was killed while doing that. Mortar shell had gotten him. And Raritan lost his hero then. Town was notified that Bazelon had been killed. The information went through the various branches of the military that this guy had been killed, because he was a very well-known hero. When he first came home, he came home to a parade that 30,000 people attended. So they lost their hero, John Bazelon. He died February 19th, 1945. And after the war, they decided they would do something for him. So they made a statue. He was always a hero. In 1981, they started the annual Bazelon Parade.
Neat. And that's in Raritan itself?
In Raritan.
Okay.
Since 1981, so we're coming up on about 37 years now.
Wow, that's a wonderful story. So where did he, did they have remains that got buried, or was he?
He was buried at Arlington. Well, initially he was buried at Iwo Jima.
Okay.
That was, and then 1948 they started to move the bodies back home.
Right.
The town, his family was contacted by the Marine Corps, and they asked, do you want to have him buried at home on the local cemeteries or at Arlington National Cemetery?
Okay.
And they thought about it. It would be nice to have him be at home, but Arlington National Cemetery really is an honor.
Right.
So it was April of 1948. The body was brought back, and it was at Arlington National Cemetery. About two dozen people from Raritan drove down that day for a very nice ceremony. One of my last articles in the Breeze was about Basil is buried at Arlington National Cemetery, and that's where he remains. His grave does say Medal of Honor recipient on it.
Okay. So I know when I think we talked about it a little bit. Last year we went to Europe and visited the Normandy area, and they told us, because when I read Bill O'Reilly's book about the war, he said nobody was brought home during the war. They were all buried there. But he didn't tell the rest of the story. What happened was after the war, you had the option of bringing your dead one, loved one back to be buried either Arlington or your local cemetery, and about a third of the men and women were brought back. But it was just like a heartbreaking story. I mean, first of all, Normandy itself was awe-inspiring. I mean, if you've watched some of the movies about it,
yes, and
some of the documentaries. But what happened in the Pacific is the same way, I'm sure, except it wasn't as concentrated. Although I saw the documentary on Iwo Jima, and the Japanese were really dug in. It was the very first time they fought this, I guess, guerrilla-type warfare to get them out from where they were.
Yeah, they fought to the death. And when you are fighting, and you fight your country, you're a brave soldier, but you prefer to live.
Right.
You want a fighting chance. You're charging across a field or something. You will do it for your buddies, for your country. But you do prefer to live. If you know it's not going to work out, you probably will stay behind your emplacement. But the Japanese almost preferred to die. They were not allowed to surrender, so that made it a very difficult fight.
Right.
The U.S., it was the only battle at Iwo Jima where the U.S. had more casualties than the enemy. I believe, this is just a guess, they lost 6,000 men, another 18,000 were injured at Iwo Jima. Battle went on 36 days.
Wow. And whereabouts is Iwo Jima? Is it near Japan?
I believe it's 500 miles from Japan, because they were hopping islands, getting closer and closer, and the Iwo Jima became a more of a rescue or a stopping area for the B-29s. B-29s were coming from Tinian and Saipan there, which was about 1,000 miles.
Okay.
Iwo Jima was half the distance, so they had to stop for any reason, and on the way back, very often they had to stop. But after they took the island and got the airfield all polished up, then it became very strategic important.
Wow.
Iwo Jima was.
Yeah, because I remember reading, I went to an Air Force base in Tucson, Arizona, which is really the boneyard. And they had a B-17 hangar, and they had a B-29 hangar. And they told us the real difference was the B-17 was a European plane, because the B-29, which was 10 years newer, had longer range. So they used that in the Far East, I guess that was considered, in the Pacific War. But both of them were manned by children and grandchildren of the men that were on the planes. And the stories they told us were just amazing.
Yes, it was to go up there in freezing.
Right.
I mean, not just a cold day, negative 40 degrees.
Right.
And they did have heaters, and they did have very thick clothes, but still, it's a totally strange environment there. And they would fly out for hours from Tinian to bomb Japan, or quite a long way from England to bomb Europe. And they were faced by three different types of danger. One was airplane malfunction, which is much more common than you would think. Which seems to happen, doesn't happen that much in training, but once the enemy is around, it seems like so many more things go wrong for whatever reason. Human error, more stress in the planes. They had the human error, they had the flak, which was shots coming from the ground up, and then they had the enemy fighter planes coming at them. So there was a lot of danger there. Some made it back, some did not. Raritan lost several men who were in the Air Force.
So I remember them telling us that the gun emplacement on the top of the plane called the shots. He actually turned guns on and off because he wanted. But the guy that was the tail gunner was the most important thing, because a enemy plane could come up and clip the tail off its propeller and not do any damage to the plane itself, but send their plane down. So he was on his own to protect the tail. But the top gunner, and you had a belly gunner, and you had side gunners. It was just amazing stories they were telling us. And I mean, you get into the heat of battle, and it's live or die. And these guys were in it for everything they were worth. And I know on the B-17s, they weren't pressurized. So I had this tube that went down in the middle of the plane. So to get from the tail gunner up to the cockpit, you had to come through this tube that was like a big kid's hula hoop toy kind of thing. And just like the logistics were nuts.
Yes, it was a very long to go out there. And one fellow who I interviewed, one of my articles, he said once the plane has some kind of damage, you wouldn't move at all because it was kind of like, you know, wobbling and all that. And one guy at 150 pounds moving from one part of the plane to the other would
destabilize it.
And so they kind of just had to stay in their own little spot.
And how many men?
Sometimes you knew your buddy was bleeding or something like that, or you weren't sure whether the radio went out to the tail gunner or to the front of the plane, or whether they were dead.
Yeah.
With a damaged plane, you could not move.
Interesting.
Just, they had the orders, and moving was most likely not worth it.
Wow. So they flew all B-29s. How many men were on a B-29 typically?
I think there was like 10 on a B-29.
That would be about my guess, too.
B-29 for the navigator, pilot, co-pilot, bombardier, and many gunners were on there.
And then the B-17s, which are more European, were 10 years older, and they were just as big, but they weren't as technologically advanced as the B-29, so they couldn't go as far or as fast. But most of my knowledge of World War II is based around Europe, but I've yet to get into the Pacific because it's just as fascinating what those guys had to go through.
Yeah, the bombing campaigns, as they got better, in the beginning it was almost a death sentence to
be
on a crew. You were supposed to fly 20 missions. And the odds of being killed were like 5 to 6%. You know, do the math there. But as things got better towards the end of the war, there was less flak.
Right.
They were smarter, and the B-29s flew so fast and so high, fast enough so that they could, even the heavy bomber plane could outrun the Japanese fighter plane. So up in the air, they got one crack at you. You went by, and they couldn't catch you.
Right.
And they also flew 5 miles high, and the flak. The fire can only go 4 miles. So towards the end of the war, those B-29s were an efficient bombing machine.
And it just got better over time. Because nobody fights a war for a living. So it sort of has to start. You got to have some experience. And then it's like there's no way you can be prepared till you're there. You get a lot of training. But the real hands-on and living through it is it's hell. I had a customer, Milton. He just died about 2 years ago. And he was a B-29 training pilot. And I remember his wife taking me one way around the house, and he went the other, and she says, you know, Milton's not getting any younger. I want to get a house that a man of his age can handle without a lot of effort. So I said, so how old is Milton? And she says, 89, but he still flies his plane every day. He had a 4-passenger Cessna that he flew. So I got to know him, and it turned out he became a 707 pilot, trained 707, which was a big plane in its time in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. But I didn't hear from them for about 5 years, and I just presume people pass on and you don't hear. I get this phone call from Marilyn, and she said, Joe, do you remember me? It's Marilyn. I was on a car phone. I said, yes, Marilyn, I do remember you. And I'm saying to myself, oh, my God, I hope Milt's okay. She says, we have a question for you. I said, how is Milt? She says, he's fine. He's 95, and we're looking to buy investment properties. And I tell people, you get out of bed with your 47-year-old body or your 53-year-old body, and you have these aches and pains. Think about a guy 95 years old that flew in World War II, 1945, still buying investment properties. Man, he was my hero. And when we went to Paris for the first time, he told us the spots to go and the spots not to go to.
He had the experience with that.
Yeah,
you know, those guys are my heroes, the old guys. I have the pleasure of interviewing the Grand Marshal for the Basel and Parade every year.
Okay.
It's usually a World War II veteran.
All right.
And they do have some stories about their various endeavors in the war. And I haven't found one bragger among them.
Right. They're very humble.
They all want to talk about the guys they were with and how they missed family and the lessons in life that they learned over there. Also, I was fortunate enough to, Raritan has a collection of 700 letters written home during World War II. They were written home to a fellow named Tony Orlando. He was like the Operation Jersey Cares of that era, where,
right,
where shoeboxing, or that they send stuff to the troops. In rarity, he sent stuff, him and a group, and they wrote him letters back, 700 letters.
Wow.
They are a treasure. I'm so glad that the family saved them. They can be seen on a terminal at the Raritan Library.
Okay.
And those will, you know, tell their stories. And a couple of quotes that I found were, some of the guys would say, I'll of course miss playing baseball this year, but I'm playing a bigger game. A game,
right,
for freedom, a game for justice.
Right.
And I, and this is the one that counts.
So how do you pick the Grand Marshal for the parade? What does that process consist of?
Well, Raritan's used to look for a World War II veteran,
but there's
who
fewer.
Was in Raritan during World War II.
Okay.
And during World War II, Raritan, with a population of 6,500 people, sent about 950 people into the fight.
Okay.
For men and some women. And even those numbers seem a bit unrealistic, but the demographics at the time were a lot of families moved to Raritan in 1910, 1920 from Italy.
Right.
So you had a lot of guys are 18, 30, a lot of kids at that age.
Yep.
So 950 people out of 6,500 were in the service then. So at one time, years ago, there were dozens or even 100 ex-World War II vets to pick for, yeah, the Grand Marshal.
Right.
But they are a dying breed.
Yep.
We have run out of the World War II veterans in Raritan who haven't already been,
okay,
the Grand Marshal. There was one left, the one fellow's modesty, he declined. So we've moved to a couple have been in the Korean War. Others have served, the fellow this year, Andy Martin, served in Vietnam.
Wow.
He went to Bridgewater Raritan High School. He played on the 1965 basketball team that won the state championship. And this was important. Back in 65, the high school was just new, Bridgewater Raritan. They were,
yep,
proud of their new high school. They had gone to Somerville. And they put him on the map to win the basketball championship in 65. Andy Martin was one of the stars. A couple of years later, when he enlisted to Vietnam, people thought he was nuts. Because they said, why are you going to Vietnam? You were a successful basketball player. This is not for you. Even the recruiter tried to dissuade him when he tried,
right,
to go. But he wanted to go, wanted to do his bit for his country, thought it looked exciting, thought there would be some camaraderie. This, you know, it was an adventure.
Yeah.
And he went to Vietnam, and he was awarded the Silver Star for rescuing some guys who were trapped in a canal under enemy fire.
Yeah.
The fellows had been trapped there for several hours in the heat, almost half a day with no water. So they couldn't even run. They were so dehydrated.
Right.
So it was a very bizarre rescue. And then him and another guy ran across an open field. Andy Martin had the smoke grenades, throwing the smoke grenades, zigzag, and the other fellow carried the water. They had guns with them, but didn't fire, just to make it to the canal where the guys were trapped. I mean, they were safe with their trap, but the fire was coming at them.
Right.
So they were able to bring gallons of water to these guys, enough so they could rejuvenate themselves and run to safety.
Huh.
For that, Andy Martin was awarded the Silver Star. And he is the Grand Marshal this year. He's
what is the date of the parade?
The date is Sunday, September 23rd.
Okay.
1 p.m. downtown Raritan. In addition to Andy riding in the convertible, we have probably six other special guests in the car. Most are World War II vets. They are the ex-Grand Marshals.
Okay.
And we're glad to still have them because we seem to lose,
yeah,
one a year.
Wow.
With them. And they are very happy to be honored with their, that all their stories have been told. They usually bring their family ride with them, or some of their friends will show up. It's just a treasure to have a link to World War II, because that will be over in a few years.
Yeah. I mean, that was ended in 44, I guess. Or is it 46?
45.
And it's, I can't count backwards, but that's 55 plus 18, 65, 73 years ago. And they were 17 or more then. So
yeah, 90.
They're all in their 90s.
Minimum wage.
It's interesting. One of the things we discovered when we went through the Normandy area is we had a whole day guide, and he took us around and showed us, first of all, the German cemetery. When we went to the German cemetery, the average age in the German cemetery was under 17 years old. They were breeding children to fight in the war and die. where the average age in a U.S. cemetery was just under 22 years old, and everybody had about 2 years' worth of experience before they got into the battle. But we still lost 9,600 men on the beach.
Yeah, they had the positions. The Germans were running out of people, so they had the Hitler Youth as they were bred, unfortunately. And they were, you know, they had been at war basically well before we entered.
Right.
Certainly, even before they fired shots, they were, for several years, they were building the military up and having their rallies. So a lot of these kids, if they were joining the service in 1944 at 17, by the time they were 10, they were brainwashed and told this is the way, so they were out there.
And we've watched the documentaries how they would send the boys and girls to camp, and they would cross-pollinate at camp, and girls would come home pregnant, 14, 15 years old, and they were having the baby for the Fuhrer. And their mother had nothing to do with it. The mothers weren't happy with it, but that's the way it was done. But then when I visited Germany 3 summers ago, they were telling us that if you had so many babies, and I forget what the number was, it was like 14 or something, you got a Volkswagen. And nobody ever got the Volkswagen because the war ended before that could possibly happen. But people were having babies just so that he had people to go to war with. I mean, we as Americans don't think that way.
No, that's part of the insanity of war. And in that case, it's the insanity to lead up to war.
Right.
And then hopefully, you know, if you ever, like, you see a lot of things on social media today, people griping about this, griping about that.
Yeah.
I think if you spend some time in other countries, you come back here and you would realize, you know, how free it is. And that, you know, you know, you might look at the politics and say, this is insane. But it's a lot more stable here, a lot more free here than most every other country.
And we went through the European, in London, we went through the Imperial Museum, which is more World War I centric for the designs, what was out when we were there. I understand they've had some fantastic World War II ones as well. And then as we went across, we did the museum at Cannes, we did the museum at Bayeux. And then we actually went out onto the beaches and into the bunkers. And it was interesting because I can't remember the name of the church, but there's a famous church where the guy's parachute got caught on the steeple on the way down. And when you go to the church, there's still a parachute hanging from the steeple to commemorate him. And the people that were on a tour of us said, you got to watch The Longest Day because that was the story about this. So we went back and we watched it. And amazingly, probably 70% of the scenes in The Longest Day, we were in those areas where the church was. We were in the bunker at the very top that they actually had removed the guns and put telephone poles in their place, and the guys were grappling up to get the guns out, and there were no guns there. Just story after story. And
that is a good way to present history, in that instead of just being in a book and this happened a long time ago in a place you can't relate to, when you're there, you can say, that building over there took the bomb. That's where they haven't repaired that part where the church on purpose. Then people relate to it.
We walked through fields that had like Swiss cheese holes, maybe 100 feet deep, 100, 200 feet wide. It were craters from shells being dropped, bombs being dropped on this area. And it's just awesome to think you were there. And you know what got me? I think of every feeling I had while I was in Normandy, was that when we finally got to Omaha Beach, it's a resort. There's people out there with umbrellas swimming. It's almost like a sacrilege to me. You know, we went there to see this, and people there are using it as part of their life. The same thing in St. Malo, the beach was a resort. So time goes on, you know.
Well, that's good in a way in that you, I once saw a book, I think I've mentioned this to you in one of our prior conversations, and had a lot of pictures of World War II of the battles in black and white.
Right.
And they put another picture next to it in color of it today.
Yep.
And they would have, you know, battle in one picture and then someone sunning and having fun in the other picture.
Right.
Where if someone, would, a mom with a kid in the stroller, and said, right, this is where the fight was, the guys died in fight.
Yep.
So that today we can have peace and we can have freedom.
And I think people lose sight of that. And I would highly recommend spending a few days of your next European trip to go through some of the history that went on over there. We had both a left bank and a right bank guided tour of Paris, which was more of an occupation than a war because the city was occupied. They capitulated. Didn't want to fight again. And the guy had us in front of the finest hotel in Paris, and he said, see those flower pots up there? He says, they're hiding machine gun holes. And he showed us a picture of the hotel. He says, here's a picture when the tanks were in the street during the occupation. And for 4.5 years, in the northern two-thirds of France, there was a German in every house and every business and every building just to make sure there was no radio contact with the outside world and there were no guns. And he said, interestingly enough, the people got to like the Germans because they were young, Aryan, 22, 23-year-olds for the most part.
Some. There were some awful atrocity stories. To be occupied just is beyond. Some people just didn't have it in them and couldn't salute and couldn't do it and eventually would be executed.
And we were in Berlin, and a woman told us the story. And she said, first of all, when you go to Berlin, they don't want to talk about the war. It was something great-grandpa did, and we still remember it, but we've moved on. And so we had to get a guide to take you and walk through. But one of the citizens sat down with us at the airport, and we told him it took us a while to get into sync with that the people didn't want to talk about it, but the history was still here, and you could go find it through guided tours. And she said, you got to think about what happened at the end of the war. She said, everybody knew what was going on. There was nobody that didn't know what was going on. If you protested, you got hung on the spot. If you sympathized, you're like a neo-Nazi today. They took you into their clan. The other 90% of the people tried to live for the 4.5 years without getting killed. So at the end of the war, she said, they couldn't draw a line and say these people were sympathizers and these weren't. Everybody knew what was going on, but most people just tried to get through it alive. And, you know, it changed my way of thinking. I think she was, of all the people I talked to, the most insightful.
I couldn't imagine how it would be there. If you resist, you just survive.
Because in other trips, we had gone through Poland and Austria, and the previous trip to Europe, we went through Munich. Munich is an interesting city. There's a lot of oldness to Munich. You know, they've got like the Glockenspiel towers where the little mannequins come out on that 15 minutes and play the chimes. But when you're in Berlin, it's all rebuilt since 1950, with the exception of one church, which is called...
It was
bombed to the ground.
Ed Morrow, the radio broadcaster, at one point at the very end of the war, he said, it looks like the buildings have been bombed down to the brick, the concrete piece, and that piece has been bombed again. And that piece has been bombed down to dust. Says the destruction is unbelievable. Just the planes, by the end, were coming in at will.
Right.
And they were bombing hopeful. The big hopeful was that air power could do it all. But eventually you have to go in on the ground. History has shown. And they did go in on the ground. And 60 million people was the total cost of World War II. And the one thing I like to say, the one book I had done about Raritan in World War II is that the war ended with the dropping of the atomic bombs.
Right.
We could debate the atomic bomb and all that, but it was like a lesson from our creator to say, he was telling us, No more of these guys.
Right.
These are the toys that you will be playing with now if you choose to do this again. And I've heard many times that the number of people who have died from war per year on the average, because there's big spikes throughout history, has gone down tremendously since the advent of the nuclear bomb. Because the big boys can't fight anymore.
And it's interesting because we had a guide when we walked through. There's two concentration camps near Krakow. One is the famous one, Auschwitz, and then is Birkenau, which is more of a killing camp. And I said to the guy, 57, you said 60, she said 57. I'm sure somewhere in those vicinities is a true number. Because she said there's no way to count accurately. She said, but 57 million people is what I tell my. So I said, okay, so I read Bill's book on Stalin. And I guess it was Killing Kennedy, and he was talking about Stalin. Maybe it was Killing Hitler, and he talked about it. It must have been Killing Hitler. And he said, Stalin killed 60 million people. I said, was that the same? Were any of those in common? She says, no. That was another 60 million people behind the Iron Curtain. The entire population of what is now the UK was killed by Stalin's regime, according to that book.
To get them in, to whip them in, into fear.
Yeah.
Some reporter, one story about Stalin, asked him when he was outside the country in Europe, was able to corner him and get him a question, and said, "When will the killing? When will you stop killing your own people?" And his answer was, "When it is no longer necessary."
Wow! Wow!
Some guy.
So you were telling me fascinating stories on how you documented people from pictures. Could you share a little bit of that? You would find a picture from the World War II and somebody's artifacts, and then you'd find a person in the picture.
Yeah. This is one story. It was a fella, Anthony Moose. He was served in World War II. He passed about 25 years ago.
Right.
But his daughters had contacted me, and they had a scrapbook.
Okay.
Of World War II scrapbook, and they knew I wrote and did various things, but I want to see it. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, I'll stop by." I said, "You know, it's kind of strange. I just got 700 World War II letters shown to me. I'm trying to go through them, categorize them, scan them in. It's a big project." So I went to their house, and they showed me the scrapbook, and they showed me that the dad had, and why this Anthony Moose was stationed in Belgium, and the U.S. stayed for a while. He had made friends with a family there, and made good friends with him. Here's a lot of pictures of him and the family, the mom, the dad, the four girls, and the brother. And I said to myself, I've read a lot of these letters, the World War II letters. I think I have your dad's World War II letters written home, talking about he met this family in Belgium. And indeed, we went to the letters and compared the pictures, and we had the two pieces to the story. It was bizarre. It was amazing.
Wow.
So we were able to read all the letters and say, "Oh, this is so-and-so, and he met these people. He gets to hang out with four lovely girls." And the mom of the family, Estebanart was the family. The mom, he called his laundry lady, and how the lady cried when he left, but he wrote him after the war. And even the brother of the Estebanart was like 16 when the U.S. was done their 2 months in Belgium and decided to move on to Germany. The brother and many other young men went with him.
Right.
The U.S. had kicked the Germans out of Belgium, so Belgian people were so grateful that we went to finish the job. They were willing to come along with them and risk their lives. So we put that story together. It was kind of neat. And then I noticed that the name of the family and their hometown was on the back of some of the pictures. So I said to his daughters, Anthony Moose's daughters, Kathy and Cindy, I said, "Let me write to Janice, Belgium, and just try to find these last names and see if we can contact the family." These kids were young.
Right.
And we wrote a letter there in three different languages because we didn't know what language they spoke. Wrote it over there, and we got a letter back. And someone said, "Yeah, we are the family." It was two stages. First was like, "I'm the distant cousin, but I'll put you in touch with other people."
Right.
So it all took a little bit. And eventually, the daughters of Anthony Moose got to talk to the brother and the sister who the father had known, and they said, they love the father. He was there for a couple months. He came by all the time. He brought the chocolates to the kids, and the Belgian people really bonded with the U.S. soldiers, especially with their dad. So the son said, "I'm coming to the U.S. next year. Maybe I can meet you."
That's neat.
So the two daughters met up with the brother. The sister, unfortunately, had passed away before the meeting. But they met with the brother, and they invited me to go with them. It was down in Baltimore. I said, "Are you sure you want me to go? I'm just a writer for the newspaper."
Yep.
They said, "Yeah, but you know all the facts and to keep the conversation going." So the daughters of Anthony Moose and me went to Baltimore, and we met Ferdinand Estemart, and he told the story about how the Germans came in, and they had to flee on foot, and it was a very difficult experience. A lot of times they were out of food. They said when the Germans came in, some people took cars, some people took mass transit, but when a million people want to move at once, 90% of them were on foot.
Right.
But then after the Germans were kicked out, they were able to come back in their homes. And there's a lot of pictures of a Christmas dinner held in January, but they went around in December, with Anthony Moose, the Estebanart family. And just pretty remarkable how his daughter, 7 years later, got to meet up with one of the guys during the war. And the day we went to Baltimore, and driving down, like, what kind of meeting is this going to be? Is this guy senile? This is going to be so awkward. We had so much fun. It was amazing, and they kept in touch afterwards. One thing leads to another. While we were there, in some of the pictures that the Estebanarts had, not only was Anthony Moose there, was a buddy of his was in a lot of the pictures too. And on the back of one of their pictures, they had the guy's name. And we were able to identify him he was still alive and talked to him as well. He was happy to talk to us.
That's amazing. So, and as you say, the years are going by, so there's less and less.
Yeah, but the fact that they wanted to talk to us, and we had lots to talk about. Each side had plenty of pictures to exchange with each other.
Because now there's some technology. If you can identify one face, it can go through your whole library and other pictures with that face and say, that's so-and-so, and put a little caption.
No, this was the old style. This was a letter typed, sent to maybe four different Estevart names in Belgium. Luckily, there was like a whitepages.com equivalent. And we got one letter back saying, you have contact with the family, but I'll forward it to my other brother-in-law.
Right.
And, you know, they contacted us back, and you're not sure of the level of enthusiasm. They were saying the war was a long time ago. I don't remember your dad. Or if I did, the war's over.
I don't want to talk
about
it.
I have no problems.
Yeah.
But the fact that family was able to meet up, it was sad.
That's an amazing story. So if people wanted to go and find out more about this in Raritan, there's a section in the library dedicated to it?
Well, then go on my website, raritan-online.
Okay. .com.
America with a dash, the word
online.com.
All my stories are up there. Stories of Bazalone, stories of the World War II letters are up there. Various profiles of gentlemen who were killed in the war, including a reverend from America who was killed. And the three-part story of Anthony Moose.
Okay.
How we first identified his scrapbook and the letters and put them together. How we wrote to Belgium, we got something back.
Right.
And the third part is how they actually met together.
So, Bruce, if one of the listeners would like to talk to you because they want to find out something more or have something to contribute, how would they contact you?
You can get my email, Bruce Dorley, which is spelled B-R-U-C-E, last name Dorley, D-O-O-R-L-Y, @gmail.com.
I'll put that on our replay of this so people can do that. So now, today, you're a party man.
I have a mobile DJ business. I had a business in the 90s.
Okay.
From 1990 to 1999. Life and opportunity took me in a different direction when I opened a full-time kids' party place where they came to me. Had that for 4 years. Then I was back to corporate America. A year ago, I went to three events during the year. I thought the DJ was marginal. I said, I got to get back into it. My daughters are older now. One's married, two are in college. So there's no more driving to various events. And I got back into the mobile DJ world. I now had to learn a laptop.
Yeah.
But one thing I found is that not much is different from the people's point of view. They're still fast dancing, slow dancing, some special songs. They are pretty much, playing the crowds pretty much the same. But there's some new songs that have mass appeal that I play, but nothing's a major difference in what I call DJ intuition.
Right.
Playing the crowd, knowing when it's time for the wild and crazy one, when it's time for a sing-along one, what requests do you take, what requests don't you take.
Yeah.
You can't clear the dance floor because one guy wants to hear Pink Floyd last hour of the wedding, so you got to make some tough calls. But I've done 9 events so far, and I kind of intentionally went slow with it so I could learn the software, learn the ropes.
Right.
Go to some DJ conferences, and now I think it was 2 weeks ago that I said to myself, nothing's holding me back now. Now it's full steam ahead.
Good for you.
So I look forward to getting back into that.
So if somebody would like to know more about your DJ business or talk about an event, how would
they can email you. Send an email.
Okay, so that's BruceDorley@gmail.com. And I'll post that on a replay of this. So if anybody's looking at this as a replay, it's going to be on the bottom.
My favorite event to DJ combines my history.
Okay.
I love the high school reunions.
Oh, wow.
They're always a trip. Everyone's dressed up. Talking about it. They've done this and they've done that. And I like to look up the songs from that era and tweak it so that you're playing songs that aren't overplayed today, but we're big in high school.
That's an interesting twist. That's an interesting twist, Bruce. Well, I appreciate you coming on.
Okay.
I think the date of the parade is September 23rd.
It's Sunday, 1 p.m.
At 1 p.m. in Raritan. I know I'm going to make a point to be there, and hopefully some of our listeners will say, I want to see what's going on and come as well. How many people does it attract typically?
Maybe a couple thousand along the route, and then you have 100 groups marching, average of 10 each, so there's another 1,000 in the parade.
Okay, and where does it end, like at a park? Or
It ends down by the Bazelon statue.
Okay. That's a fascinating, and thank you so much for keeping the history going. It's just
my pleasure, a
fabulous story, and I can see it's a labor of love.
Yeah, oh yeah, I love what I do. It's I get a small pittance to write for the local paper, I would probably do it for nothing.
And thank you for introducing me to the Breeze, because I write an article for you.
Yes, I see your column in there now. Yes, she loves people that have the passion to come up with something new every month. The first couple months is easy.
Yeah, you're right. It's like, I know when I did it today for this last month, that March, and I said, it's a little too close to the month before. Next time I'm going to have to call a whole new format so that, because there's so much going on, I'm just thinking the readers should be interested, and it'll help them know more of understanding. I like to tell my listeners that it's pretty hard to understand what's happening, but most people can grasp that. It's almost impossible to understand why it's happening, and what I try to do in my newsletter is to get down to that level, and we've got some big changes going on, and they're changing the way we live, and as a result, it's getting harder to sell certain types of houses, and we have no inventory in a popular one. So I'm going to play my commercial one more time before we break, but we got about 60 seconds left. What would you like to say in that last 60 seconds?
I enjoyed being here. I think we've kind of said it all. I love the fact that you have this radio station here with the Chamber of Commerce. I'm sure that a lot of guys come up with creative ideas, and the other gentleman told me before I went on, you have like 20 different hosts that do things here.
Yes.
So yeah, it would be a great toy. I want to see if we can get this in the in some other chamber that I'm in.
Well, and I guarantee you, when we go downstairs, I'll look at how many people. We probably had a couple of dozen views of this program already, because people tune in, because it's going live over Facebook. Bruce, thanks for coming on. I'm going to play my commercial one more time, or we're going to go to the news.
One of the biggest decisions in your lifetime is buying or selling a house. Choosing a realtor with strong client communication, technology, and marketing skills will dramatically improve your chance of success. That's why Hunterdon and Somerset's residents rely on Joe Peters. Joe believes his clients deserve a smooth and seamless experience, not a roller coaster ride. As a Coldwell Banker sales associate with 20 years of experience, he's helped hundreds of people to achieve their goals and dreams, no matter where they were in the buying or selling process. Joe accomplishes this by approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, he tries to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them his own. Then he takes the mass amount of data that's available and distills it down to a few understandable action points. And finally, he controls the entire process through technology and marketing. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let Joe show you how to take his professional expertise and put it to work for you. To contact Joe, go to jpeters.com or call 908-238-0118.
Listeners, thank you for tuning in. I hope you found Bruce as entertaining as I did. And I'll be back next week with Kate Roa, and we're going to talk a little about digital marketing campaigns and how they can assist you in both your business and your lifestyle. Thank you for tuning in. We're going to the news.
USA Radio News.
After weeks of speculation, growing public anger, and questions over the future of online digital privacy, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified before Congress for the first time today. Take a listen to a little bit of the exchange between Senator Ted Cruz and Zuckerberg.
Do you know the political orientation of those 15 to 20,000 people engaged in content review?
No, Senator. We do not generally ask people about their political orientation.
So as CEO, have you ever made hiring or firing decisions based on political positions or what candidates they supported?
No.
Why was Palmer Luckey fired?
That is a specific personnel matter that seems like it would be inappropriate to
speak. You just made
a
specific representation that you didn't make decisions based on political views.
Well,
is that accurate?
I can commit that it was not because of a political view.
Luckey is the inventor of the Oculus Rift, which was purchased by Facebook. Facebook then fired Luckey, and some believe it's based on his political leanings and his support of Donald Trump. This is USA Radio News.
Okay, so the big question for any decision you're going to make, is this actually going to work? Well, if you've heard about MediShare, which is a brilliant way of sharing healthcare costs, you may have wondered that. Does it work? Well, so did Dr. Stuart Hoover, who initially joined to save a lot of money. The typical family saves about $500 a month. Stuart saved even more.
When we first joined MediShare, we were immediately going from a little over $1,600 a month down to $460 basically a month.
So that's wonderful, but then his wife needed emergency surgery, and the bills added up to $160,000.
So we were seeing the bills coming in, and then the bills were being paid. Portions were being shared, and the end result of this is this bill was taken care of.
Yes, MediShare works, and it's so easy to get your questions answered, too.